The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic and the online edition of the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And we're going to begin today's journey on Armchair Traveler in an ancient village north of Jerusalem in Israel. As a photo caption explains, recently completed excavations of a Roman-era synagogue reveal elaborate mosaics and upend long-held beliefs about ancient Jewish life. Now, this photo is from an article titled Surprising Scenes in Stone, written by Ann R. Williams, and the photo is taken by Paola Versoni. The article appeared in the April 2024 issue of National Geographic, so let us begin. When archaeologist Jody Magnus climbed to the sunny hilltop overlooking the Sea of Galilee in the summer of 2010, she was unsure what she might find there. An ancient Jewish village known as Hukkah once stood on the site in northeastern Israel, but all that remained above ground was a jumble of centuries-old building stones, modern debris, and wild mustard plants. Magnus, a professor of early Judaism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a National Geographic explorer, had spent years leading excavations in Israel and suspected this hilltop was worth exploring. By the following summer, she and her team had discovered a stone wall running north-south, some even 7 feet below ground. Several pieces of evidence, including a main doorway oriented toward Jerusalem, revealed that it was the perimeter of a synagogue that had been constructed some 1,600 years ago. In the early 5th century, similar buildings of that era had floors paved with flagstones, but as the team kept digging, they unearthed more and more small mosaic stones called tesserae, a hint that something truly special might lie beneath. On a hot day in June 2012, Brian Bozong, a recent graduate of Brigham Young University, was carefully removing dirt from his excavation square when he scraped against something hard at floor level. Now, he alerted Magnus, and as she brushed away the remaining dirt, the two were stunned to see the face of a woman, delicately traced in tesserae, staring up at them. It was the first section of a mosaic to come to light. Over the next decade, Magnus returned to Hukkah each June with an international team of experts and student volunteers. She had originally planned to spend only 5 seasons excavating part of the site, but quickly realized she was in for a much longer haul. The project goals would now have to include preserving whatever was left of the mosaic floor, and what was left, revealed slowly year after year, turned out to be extraordinary. The outline of the synagogue, when fully exposed, was about 65 feet long and by 55 feet wide. The entire expanse of the floor had been covered in expertly rendered mosaic panels, though only about half of that original floor remained intact. Usually in an ordinary church or synagogue, you have 1, 2, or 3 scenes presented, but here you have many more, says Gideon Avni, chief archaeologist with the Israel Antiquities Authority, which licensed the excavation. It's probably the best, most diverse concentration of mosaics in the country, he said. Many of the surviving mosaics depict stories from the Hebrew Bible, pairs of creatures such as camels, donkeys, elephants, and lions heading toward Noah's Ark, the Red Sea engulfing the Egyptian army, carpenters and masons building the Tower of Babel, Samson carrying the gate of Gaza on his shoulders. There's a lot of evidence in these mosaics, a lot of blood and gore, says Magnus, but there's also some humor. Among the most gruesome scenes, depiction from the Book of Judges in which Kenite woman named Jael hammers a tent stake through the head of the Canaanite general Sisera. By contrast, a whimsical twist on the story of Jonah, portrays the hapless prophet being swallowed by 3 successively larger fish. The mosaics also borrowed motifs from classical art, including Cupid's theater mask and the Greek god of the sun, Helios, who rides in his chariot, surrounded by the symbols of the zodiac. Hookock may have been a village in the countryside, but it wasn't isolated, says DIG Assistant Director Dennis Mitzi, senior lecturer in Hebrew and Ancient Judaism at the University of Malta. It was connected with the wider Mediterranean world, and that means the community was aware of a wide range of traditions and comfortable enough with ideas from outside its own area, he said. While there are still questions about how exactly the synagogue originated, the discovery of its remains is now rewriting history, particularly our understanding of how Jews lived with foreign rule or under foreign rule. Romans conquered the land east of the Mediterranean, including Galilee, in the 1st century B.C. Initially, they recognized Judaism as an ancestral religion. Jewish people were allowed to live according to their own laws and were granted exemptions, such as not having to worship the emperor. That really doesn't change significantly until Christianity becomes a legal religion in the Roman Empire and then the empire's official religion, says Magnus. Once that happens in the 4th century, legislation becomes increasingly restrictive of Judaism. New laws sometimes banned the construction of synagogues. If you were going on the basis of that alone, you would think that Jews were persecuted, that they were oppressed, says Magnus, of the people in this region. But at Hookock, the existence of a grand synagogue adorned with bold artistic expressions offers clear evidence that despite tensions, daily life in Galilee may not have been so dismal. Among all the mosaics, one panel is especially dazzling and puzzling. More finely crafted than the rest of the floor, with large sections still intact, it's divided into three horizontal registers. At the bottom, defeated soldiers, a battle elephant, and a bull are dying from bloody spear wounds. In the middle, stone arches shelter men wearing tunics, and at the top, two male leaders are meeting, one in a tunic and the other in armor, each accompanied by his followers. Magnus thinks the one in armor is Alexander the Great. His followers are soldiers with battle elephants. He wears the diadem and purple cloak of a king, but it is not identified by an inscription. There's only one Greek king in antiquity who was so great that he didn't need a label, Magnus says, and that alone, that being the case, rather, this mosaic may represent an encounter between the high priest of Jerusalem and Alexander during the famed conqueror's battles against the Persians in the 4th century B.C. The story, likely a cherished legend rather than the truth, circulated in Jewish communities for centuries. The point of the legend is to show that even Alexander the Great, the greatest of the Greek kings, acknowledged the greatness of the God of Israel, Magnus suggests. This masterpiece, along with the rest of the mosaic panels, was probably laid by specialists from a local family-owned workshop. An inscription by the main door lists several names of people identified as artisans, perhaps the very ones who created the floor. There appear to be brothers within a single family, as well as perhaps a couple of other figures, says Renan Bustan, a historian of Judaism at Princeton University. A senior artist would have designed the floor and traced out the figures in every panel. Experienced mosaicists fashioned details like faces, hands, and feet, while junior workers filled in backgrounds and the larger fields of color. They worked with stones from the region, cut into long rods on site, and then snipped into tiny cubes. The quality of a mosaic depends on the size of the tesserae. The smaller they're cut, the more details they create. Mosaic specialists measure the number of tesserae per square decimeter. That's about 15 square inches. In some places at Hookock, the count is as low as 175. In others, it's around 230, but the mysterious three-tiered mosaic comes in at about 500. The density readings in that area approximate what you would find in Constantinople, an imperial mosaic, says Karen Britt, a mosaic specialist at Northwest Missouri State University. But that's not the only ostentatious part of the building. Judging from uncovered, or rather recovered, flecks of colorful plaster, portions of the interior may have been brightly painted, inspiring DIG members to dub it the Disco Synagogue. Magnus herself calls it the kitschiest synagogue ever. Parts of the building's interior were probably painted red, white, pink, and yellow, a theme that may have extended to the exterior. Throughout the excavation, Magnus and her team revealed the mosaics in sections, exposing the different areas to be cataloged and photographed before covering them back up to protect them in place. After taking into account other finds in the region, Magnus now believes that Hukak's over-the-top design may be evidence of inter-Jewish competition. All the villages in the area are building synagogues, and they're all pretty spectacular, she says. But here people decided they were going to build the mother of all synagogues, likely two stories tall and situated at a high point in the village. It must have been visible for a great distance. Such a lavish structure did not come cheap. Perhaps wealthy patrons underwrote the cost, but more likely villagers of lesser means may have been raking enough money to donate to a construction fund. And at least in the 5th century, Jews in the remote part of the empire seemed to have been prospering. But they may have had concerns about how long their religious freedom might last, and they appear to have expressed those concerns on the floor of their synagogue. I think they're grappling with the reality that they're in a rapidly Christianizing world, says Mosaic specialist Britt. One way of doing that is to say, look, this is not all that different from periods in the past when Israelites had to deal with other foreign powers, whether it's the Philistines, the Canaanites, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, and now Christian Romans. Bustan, the historian of Judaism, agrees, adding that the theme of God's deliverance through human warriors in the face of foreign domination is something that comes across very strongly. And yet, some generations after it was built, the synagogue was mysteriously abandoned. Given the region's long history of catastrophic seismic activity, it's not hard to imagine an earthquake leaving the synagogue so damaged that it was thought to be unsafe, even though it continued to stand. Eventually, parts of the building collapsed, destroying sections of the mosaics. Another tremor may have delivered the final blow. It wasn't burned. It wasn't taken apart, says Martin Wells, the project's architecture specialist from Austin College in Texas. He says, my guess is an earthquake. In any case, some 800 years after the synagogue was constructed, the region came to be ruled by the Mamluks, a Muslim dynasty based in Egypt. A Mamluk road, part of a network connecting Cairo and Damascus, ran right by the village and brought a flow of merchants and pilgrims. As the area became prosperous once again, the Jewish people who remained repaired the 5th century synagogue while also expanding it and adding a thick concrete-like base, which fortunately protected the mosaics. Beginning in the 15th century, commercial traffic in the area slowed. The synagogue appears to have been abandoned again, and it gradually tumbled to the ground. So it remained under the archaeologist until, rather, the archaeologist arrived. 12 years after they first started digging, Magnus and her team completed their field work in the summer of 2023. The site remains backfilled to protect the mosaics and has been turned over to the Israel Antiquities Authority and the Jewish National Fund to develop plans for tourism. IAA archaeologist Avni predicts this jewel in the crown of Israel's cultural heritage will become one of its greatest attractions. The diggings may be done, but there is much excavated material now in storage in Jerusalem to be analyzed. And many mysteries remain to be solved, Magnus says. My team and I will be coming back for years. So I suspect my friends will be hearing more about that, right? Well, an article headlined Jonah and the Stormy Sea, or if you want to pronounce it properly in the Hebrew language, Yonah, the J is silent. Jonah and the Stormy Sea was included in the article we just read. Now, the author is Ann Williams, and she's going to explain how discoveries at Hukak reveal a slightly different version of this well-known story of the Old Testament prophet, Jonah. Now, in the Bible, the prophet Jonah refuses to preach against the sinful city of Nineveh, as God has commanded. Instead, he flees on a ship. God then whips up a violent storm, which threatens to wreck the ship. When Jonah confesses to the crew that the storm must be his fault, they throw him overboard to save their fragile vessel. Underwater, Jonah is swallowed by a big fish, often rendered as a whale. The interpretation in Hukak, which is pictured here in this article, is the earliest known depiction of the tale in an ancient Jewish context, and it has a twist that appears in later Jewish and Islamic written sources. Now, here we go with about 10 different steps. First of all, number one, Jonah is swallowed by a succession of three fish. And located in the synagogue's nave, the panel presents a host of other intriguing details. Second, a balding, bearded man dangling a looped rope into the sea, and that may be the ship's captain. His gray hair hints that he is older, and he presumably has years more experience than the rest of the crews. Now, a sailor at the top of the ship's mast, and this is item number 3 from this picture, points to a trio of harpies or sirens, the personification of tempestuous wind standing on a cloud. Now, the strange hybrid creatures with the head of a woman and wings, feet, and tail of a bird are playing a lyre and a flute and dancing to the music. Then we move into the next next 4 items. We have marine animals include what may be a sea snake wrapped around a barracuda. Then we have an octopus. And the 6th item, a dolphin. And number 7 is a fish that has been identified as a red snapper. And a sea bass is the 8th item. 2 more items to go. And number 9 is a fisherman casting a net from a small boat. And a man wringing water from a fishing net with a partner. And parenthesis states only partly preserved. This represents task in the daily life of a mariner. So an interesting play on the story of Jonah, familiar to many of you, I'm sure. But that's how it's depicted from that synagogue mosaic. Well, Dylan Mullen writes for the Baltimore Sun. Now, earlier this year, and we're talking about digging again, he sought to learn more about the archaeologists who are seeking to uncover Maryland's indigenous history, layer by layer, i.e. another dig. Now, his article, The Details Are in the Dirt, also appeared in the January 7th, 2024 online edition of the News and Observer. So, let us begin. And as a photo here, it shows Towson University Assistant Professor Catherine Sterner pouring soil collected at the site of the Baltimore Community Archaeology Lab at Herringmon Park. And she's helping Nick Peterson. He's a TU senior archaeology major, and they're sifting and looking for debutage or chips of tools made from stones. Now the main article. Catherine Sterner and her students dug up a pile of dirt every 15 meters and sift. The survey of Herring Park eventually strikes a promisingly dense patch of rocks, perhaps pieces of tools or weapons, so the team excavates a full square meter. Now, just take a yardstick and extend that just slightly, a couple of inches, and you got roughly a meter there, and then put that as a square. That's how big this is. In stained soil, Sterner spots post moles, signs of a wooden structure from hundreds or maybe even thousands of years ago. Now, we have a semicircular line of 3 posts, Sterner says. Now, we dig down through the darker upper layer of soil to get down to the lighter colored soil or layer of soil. If you dig down to that and there are still darker color stains, that means somebody else also has dug down there. From the coastline to Appalachia, archaeology in Maryland uncovers sites that illuminate a still murky picture of the land's indigenous and European settler past. Academic and volunteer excavations, such as Sterner's project through Towson University's Baltimore Community Archaeology Lab, are relatively rare, as the vast majority of digs are mandated by federal and local legislation for new development. Meanwhile, the ancestors of the land's original inhabitants don't always view the destructive science as worthwhile. Archaeology has always been a love-hate relationship with me. At any moment, you could be digging one of my relatives, says Rico Newman, who traces his family to what is now the Chesapeake Bay and the St. Mary's River, and retired from the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in 2009. I've gotten past that and become part of Archaeology Society of Maryland. It's a validation. We weren't in the census, so these artifacts are like our records, he said. In recent years, Herring Run Park has been home to volunteer digs through the Herring Run Archaeology Project, which has excavated a house belonging to a 17th century slave owners as well as other indigenous sites. Back in 2021, we excavated a site that included 11,000 years of human history in one site, said Lisa Krause, co-founder of the Herring Run Archaeology Project and an archaeologist for the Maryland State Highway Administration. The most recent survey of the park from October to December in northeast Baltimore, conducted by Sterner, an assistant professor at Towson University and director of the Baltimore Community Archaeology Lab, 2 paid student researchers and volunteers, will be submitted into the state's database, which is not accessible to the public. Sterner said she could analyze radiocarbon and wood remains to tell when the tree died, but would prefer to uncover bone or organic residue on pottery. She also said she hopes to come back in the summer to look for more artifacts that can be identified and dated by matching them to a diagnostic database of artifacts that have been uncovered and dated elsewhere. I know too much about dirt, Fidel Green said. One of the project's student researchers said while sifting Earth, "There is the nerdy side of history and getting to know what happened here, and then we all have a little caveman brain that makes it fun to go out and dig holes and find rocks that were smashed into other rocks." In Maryland and across the country, most archaeological surveys are spurred by federal and state laws that require projects funded with public money to consider cultural resources. Maryland Department of Planning Chief Archaeologist Mac McKnight said Anne Arundel County and Annapolis have stricter archaeology requirements in their building codes, leading to more projects. Since the state started recording data in 1969, there have been 133 archaeological sites recorded in Annapolis and 1,759 sites in Anne Arundel County, compared with 218 in Baltimore City and 626 in Baltimore County. Archaeology is a destructive science, so we are destroying sites as we excavate them. We maintain accurate and very detailed records in the main way we ensure things are done correctly and scientifically. We can't construct a site, reconstruct a site, but can reconstruct what happened at a site, McKnight said. Maryland specifically, there is basically every kind of archaeology you would want to do in Maryland. Carbon dating doesn't work on rocks, so archaeologists digging up stone tools or ceramics rely on databases and layered soil to determine the age of artifacts. Styles changed over time. That is as true for cars as it is for pottery, as it is for stone tools. And archaeologists for many, many, many years have developed elaborate sequences, McKnight said. Stratified sites with multiple soil layers can go back in time, and sites that are really well preserved stacked up over time. Zach Singer, an archaeologist with the state, said that along with the Chesapeake Bay, oyster roasting pits have been left behind enough matter to be carbon dated. This is not so much the search for interesting objects to be put into a museum. What archaeology is really more akin to is crime scene investigation. It's more like trying to reconstruct past human behavior, Singer said. McKnight said improvements in radar technology and accessibility over the last 5 years have made field operations more efficient. Radar allows us to do a small survey project within 2 to 3 days. Excavation is a very time-consuming, and if we know the area of interest, we can go out with remote sensing that allows us to make the most of our time being out in the field. Newman traces his ancestry not to tribes, but specific plains. Or places, I should say. His dad's family was from Potokapo, which settlers turned into Port Tobacco, and his mom was from Chaptico. We were pushed away from our homelands. We didn't have cemeteries. Early on, I wasn't enamored with archaeology and archaeologists because I would have to explain to them, I know where my parents are buried, but I don't know where their parents are buried, Newman said. Newman was on the Maryland Commission on Indian Affairs from 2002 to 2009 and said he unsuccessfully lobbied to make the state's database of archaeological sites public. He also has unsuccessfully fought a law that allows property owners to keep artifacts found on their land. They can blank out the part to tell you exactly where the site is. You don't have to give me that pinpoint location, but you can give me the information part of the narrative part of my story, Newman said. In the 1980s, Newman said he passed an oral history from his grandmother to archaeologists from St. Mary's College of Maryland to help them locate a former Chaptico reservation where his mom's family lived until settlers forced them away. Dennis Seymour, chair of the Baltimore American Indian Center Museum, said his father was from the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. He said archaeology around Baltimore can help identify who lived in the area before colonization and who was trading or passing through. It's reported John Smith encountered well over 40 tribes on the Chesapeake Bay. I think the value of the archaeology is it can better establish the tribes that truly did inhabit the Baltimore area before first contact or shortly thereafter, Seymour said. What is tricky about the archaeology is there was so much trade. It's confusing. Locally, we found artifacts that would be clearly as far away as Ohio. There was a nomadic trend to come to Chesapeake Bay in the summertime, he said. So lots of interesting stuff there, and I'm sure those continued diggings will bring us more stories in the future. Well, also appearing in the April 2024 issue of National Geographic, from which we've read a couple of these stories, is another story titled Eye to the Sky. Now, as the editors note, in Wisconsin, the world's largest refracting telescope is once more open to visitors. Bill Newcott is the writer, and some photos were taken by Christy Hem Koch. Inside the dome of Yerkes University, or observatory, excuse me, tucked away along the shore of Wisconsin's Geneva Lake in the town of Williams Bay, it is emphatically 1897. The still-rotating metal half-spheres, dominated by an enormous, lovingly polished refracting telescope, a 60-foot-long, 6-ton contraption with two 40-inch lenses at one end and an eyepiece in the other. The thing is almost ridiculously fanciful. If an astronomer or visitor wants to look through that eyepiece, an operator flips an ancient switch and the dome's entire circular floor, 75 feet in diameter, one of the world's largest elevators, rises 23 feet to give the person access. Then, in a maneuver similar or familiar to any backyard stargazer, the viewer takes hold of the massive telescope with two hands and physically shifts the impeccably balanced device toward the desired point of light. Ironically, the cost of maintaining all of this low-tech equipment is dauntingly high. Today, as tour groups shuffle through Yerkes, it is easy to forget that the observatory nearly met with a wrecking ball if the University of Chicago closed it in 2018. They called Yerkes the birthplace of modern astrophysics, but when I visited the facility 2 years ago, it looked more like a place teetering on extinction. The monumental telescope was draped in thick, clouded plastic sheeting that movie gangsters tend to use to wrap the bodies of their victims. It was a humbling state for a precision device that was once a magnet for the elite of astrophysicists and theoretical astronomers, and names like Albert Einstein, Edwin Hubble, Gerard Kuiper, and Carl Sagan among them. Even as I tried to make out the telescope above, Yerkes was being reborn thanks to a $15 million facelift, inside and out, financed by a nonprofit group that took possession of the building in 2020. For the first time in more than a century, the observatory, including its 50-acre grounds, is open to the public for tours, and that includes its working space science facility. Over the past few years, Yerkes staff has been preparing for what they expect to be one of the busiest days the institution's ever seen. North America's total solar eclipse, which occurred on April 8, 2024, Williams Bay saw about a 90.2% totality, and Wisconsinites, who didn't want to drive hundreds of miles to witness complete darkness, found a no more compelling setting than for near totality than beneath the storied domes there at Yerkes Observatory. The glories of the Yerkes are not confined to the heavens. The building itself is a thing of beauty, festooned with elaborate Victorian-era stone carvings, Romanesque arches, and terracotta figures. The landmark observatory created by George Ellery Hale and Charles Tyson Yerkes, two men with two totally different agendas, but they somehow managed to get things done. Hale was an astrophysicist. Yerkes was a little bit different. He was more into the architectural side of things. He was a financier and one of Chicago's most hated businessmen, if you can believe that. So quite a story there, and that's only an excerpt. If you'd like to learn more, again, go to the current April issue of the National Geographic and look for Eye to the Sky. My friends, that brings us to the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. The website again, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.